Hello, listeners. It is Thursday, May 4th, 2017. I'm Scott Bland, your host. May the 4th be with you. This is the podcast you are looking for. You are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. We're going to start off this week's show where we have started off a number of episodes in recent months, healthcare. House Republicans finally felt like they found a healthcare plan that can pass through the chamber this week. We'll talk about how they got there just when it looked like things were collapsing. That vote is scheduled later today. And that chaos in the legislative process was mirrored by a frantic week at the White House and turmoil at one of the conservative movement's oldest institutions in Washington, the Heritage Foundation. Former Senator Jim DeMint is out as president of the think tank, and our panel, which broke the story last week, will tell you why that matters. And we'll also take a look at the people already retiring from the House of Representatives and how that will affect the 2018 elections and just generally everything in Washington. Some quick housekeeping before we dive in. Remember, you can email us with questions at nerdcast@politico.com. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a written review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. The more reviews and feedback we get, the higher we rise on the charts and the easier it is for more people like you to discover us and create Nerdcast Nation and eventually help us take over the world. I think that's the plan. One more thing along those lines. We've created a survey to better get to know our listeners and create an even better show. So listeners, please take 2 minutes of your time to fill out a quick survey at politico.com/podcast survey. That's one word, politico.com/podcast survey. And one more thing. A message from our sponsor this week. This week's episode of the Nerdcast is sponsored by Delta Airlines, constantly innovating in the air and on the ground. Delta is committed to raising the standards of air travel for everyone. Delta, keep climbing. All right, that is more than enough for me. Let's hear from the rest of the Nerdcast crew. Senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian, welcome.
Hi, Scott Bland.
Chief investigative reporter Ken Vogel, back in the studio.
That's me, hello.
And senior reporter Nancy Cook, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's jump right into data point number one. That is 216. That is the magic number of votes in the House this week once again, as they have scheduled a Thursday vote on an Obamacare repeal bill. With no regard for the Nerdcast taping schedule, I might add, 216 votes carries the day. Anything less, and the bill goes down. So Nancy, literally just days ago, this latest effort to revive Obamacare repeal and replace appeared to be dead. It was resurrected last week, and then more and more House Republicans announced they'd vote no, including influential veteran members like Congressman Fred Upton of Michigan. So what happened to get us to this point today where we have this vote scheduled later in the afternoon?
Yeah, so basically, there have just been a lot of policy disputes among the House Republicans about what needs to be in the bill. And a lot of this, the whole sort of larger theme of this is that they've really had to, you know, weaken the Obamacare sort of rules even further to get it to appeal to the people on the far right of the House, like the House Freedom Caucus. And it's been this sort of balancing act with how to appeal to them, with to how to appeal to the more moderates. So the bill that we're looking at today has a bunch of the things that we've talked about in the past, like it's going to give states the ability to weaken or opt out of these things called essential health benefits that Obamacare said it had to cover. And that includes everything from paying for prescription drugs to maternity care. And then also one of the major things that happened this week is that it's also going to mean that, insurers can charge people with pre-existing conditions a lot more money. It can charge people who are older or sicker much higher premiums, and it gives states the flexibility to do that. Originally, those policy ideas picked off some Republicans, including Fred Upton of Michigan, but then the White House and the House sort of came up with this little compromise. There's going to be this $8 billion amendment that will allegedly cover people that have pre-existing conditions. Health policy experts say that's not enough money, but that's sort of the compromise that has brought us to where we are today.
So let's assume, as we're looking forward on this, a vote has been called. Typically, votes are only called in Congress once you have the votes to pass them, although we've certainly seen that not quite pan out in the past. But Charlie, what the political ramifications of this are going to be massive. We may not know all of them yet, but sifting through, Democrats are expected to vote against this en masse, and there are going to be a number of Republican defections, but potentially not enough to prevent this bill from passing. But this is already gearing up to be the political fight of the next year and a half.
Yeah, I think, first of all, we have to throw old assumptions out the window when it comes to how things operate now, because in the past, maybe that is how the House operated, where you only called a vote when you had the votes. Now, you never really know when you have the votes. I think that the place is so splintered. So you call it because the White House wants it really badly and because they also understand that if they go away, they're going to bleed some votes. Possibly they're going to lose their momentum. So they have the vote today. And I mean, I think the politics of it are pretty fascinating. It's not this time. It's not the Freedom Caucus on the, right part of the Republican spectrum. It's the moderates who are, really, the subject of much discussion and focus. And, you know, obviously they have a problem with the pre-existing condition issue. And part of that problem, is reflective of their districts, meaning the moderates, and when I say moderates, there really aren't that many moderates in the Republican conference.
But some
anymore.
Of their districts are moderate.
Yeah, it's their districts are moderate, and so you've got reasonably moderate members, moderate conservatives, some conservatives, just folks that really aren't on the edge of the ideological continuum. So those members, you know, they represent districts where it is not a lockdown Republican district, and they have to – they take in all sorts of other considerations, and obviously they're very concerned. They see the polling on pre-existing conditions. That's the one thing that we did a poll with Morning Consult last week, and that is the one thing that everyone can agree on. Because when you look at the poll numbers that come back, they're amazing these days. And, this is across the board for every poll. The level of polarization is off the charts. Democrats and Republicans don't agree on anything, night, day, anything. So in the polls, though, this was one of the rare instances where we saw nearly half of each, Republicans and Democrats, felt that this was an important provision, maybe the most important one in the bill. And I think that's being reflected in the debate right now.
And those polls, not necessarily that poll, but the polls have shown that Obamacare, as these Republican efforts to repeal and replace it have gotten mired in controversy, as actually its numbers are strong. Its popularity is increasing in some ways and in some places. Yet that said, and per your breakdown of sort of the dynamics in play in the House Republican Conference, I think the lesson that Republicans will take going away from this, if this vote is successful, is that they don't need to cater to the moderates, that this bill was very much an effort to reach out to the conservatives and not repeat the mistakes that we saw in the original embarrassing debacle for Trump and Paul Ryan, where the House Freedom Caucus was the ones that sank this. This time around, they ended up bringing on board and very closely working with Mark Meadows, the chair of that House Freedom Caucus, and all indications are, whether this is successful or not, that this was a better process, much better than the first go-around, and presents politically and presents much more of a sort of blueprint for them going forward about how Donald Trump can form a coalition with House Republicans to pass pieces of legislation.
But here's the thing. They don't cater to the moderates to begin with. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, the moderates are clustered. The moderates tend to be from the Northeast. You know, it's almost all of them are north of the Mason-Dixon line.
But I mean, they did do that in the first go around. They reached out. I remember the New York, York members got like a special provision in there.
Yeah. I mean, just in general, on most bills, they're almost looked on as apostates, not true believers, since the rest of the caucus is really clustered in the South and in the West and in the Midwest.
Nancy is gesticulating wildly.
Much to say about healthcare. well, part of the thing that I'll be interested in watching is, you know, so they're taking this vote and it'll be interesting to see if they get the numbers. And then if they do get the numbers and pass the bill, they're all going home for a week. There's House congressional recess. And I think it will be fascinating because this pre-existing condition basically means that, you know, it's a huge number of people actually that would be considered having a pre-existing condition. Like if you're a baby and you're born with a birth defect, that's a pre-existing condition. If you're a woman and you've had a baby and you've had a C-section, which 30% of women who've had babies in the U.S. have had, that's a pre-existing condition. And so there's all these things like you think you're healthy or, you know, you don't have diabetes or cancer, but there's all these other things that would be covered in that. And I feel like the Democrats are going to make a huge stink about that next week. And also, I just want to add that like all of the major healthcare advocate groups, hospitals, doctors, patient advocates, including the AARP, are livid about this. I mean, the AARP was sending out these crazy tweets the other day, basically saying like, this infuriates our 38 million members. Do not vote for
this.
They're
airing very aggressive radio ads just right over the river right now from D.C. and Virginia, where Barbara Comstock is one of these moderate Republican representatives who said she's going to vote no.
Congress has just introduced a new age rating bill. And I was like, what the heck is age rating? But then Charlie explained that as Washington politicians speak for overcharging older Americans for their health insurance while lining the insurance company's pockets. So I looked into it, and he's right.
But the combination of that, that being the consensus in the healthcare community from these healthcare interest groups, with the Democrats' ability to mobilize, demonstrated ability to mobilize around this, I think really sort of redounds to the potential detriment of Republicans when they go home for this recess. And that could potentially be very significant, because let's not forget, this would not be the end if this passes. This has to go to the Senate. Senate's probably going to make some changes. It's going to have to go to a conference between the Senate and the House. And the longer that takes and the more chance there is for these interest groups and the Democrats to express opposition, the more difficult it becomes to pass it.
And the fact that the White House did not include any of these special interest groups in the negotiating is like another interesting sort of data point on how this came together. Because Obama, you know, there were a lot of critics who said that they didn't like the way the Affordable Care Act came together. But the way that it came together was by sort of having all these goodies for these special interest groups.
Which then aired ads supporting it very much different from what we're seeing now.
Right. And so, you know, basically the White House basically this time around negotiated with, you know, individual House members, excluded all the special interest groups and sort of came to a consensus. And maybe that's how they'll do something else like tax reform. But it is a really different way of putting together legislation.
Yeah, good luck like locking out the Chamber of Commerce on tax reform, you know?
Nancy, here's the one part I don't understand, and you are probably best positioned of anyone at Politico or certainly in this room to explain this.
It's a low bar.
I don't understand the money behind the compromise. This idea that $8 billion is going to pay for or at least bridge that divide or bridge that gap, it just seems to me like a drop in the bucket.
It is a drop in the bucket. And interestingly, even Representative Upton yesterday said, you know, he told reporters, well, I don't really know if it'll actually cover everyone. I mean, he himself, he understands healthcare quite well. And he wasn't sure of it. And all these health policy experts say, absolutely, it will not cover it. And so I feel like it's this, you know, gesture to Republicans to say, you know, we're making an effort and there will be these high risk pools. But those in the past, you know, they've done this before. They've done high risk pools. There's a lot of data you can look at it about that. And the math hasn't worked in the past. And it's meant a lot of people don't have coverage.
That's why I'm not totally convinced they have the votes today, because I just have this sneaking suspicion that the members that do their homework, and clearly, as we all know, that's not the whole House, that there will be members who do their homework, moderates who are sort of on the fence, undecided, and will be hearing from people, serious people who they respect in the healthcare field, that will say the math here, it just doesn't make sense. It's not going to cover it.
Well, it's very hard for them to even do their homework, because I don't know how many of them have actually seen a text of the bill. And if they have, maybe it was just this morning at 9 a.m., the votes at 1. And also the Congressional Budget Office has not scored this particular legislation. So we have no idea, you know, what it will cost, if it will add to the deficit, how many people will lose coverage. And that's going to be also a huge talking point for Democrats, because the Republicans made a ton of noise about when Obamacare was passed that the Democrats had to wait for a CBO score. And actually, they ultimately did. And now the Republicans are not. So there's kind of like no math for them to even fall back on.
To be clear, the bill we're talking about the kind of main part of it is still, it's the same bill that was scheduled for a vote in March and never came up, and it now has had amendments added to it that are the product of negotiations we talked about last week between the Freedom Caucus and the Tuesday group, that moderate Republican group, but then also on top of it, this new Fred Upton amendment. Ken, really, really briefly, we've talked about offline a little bit kind of the disorganized manner in which this came together, is, you know, very reactive to each step, to the number of votes and stuff. And I wonder if this is symptomatic of something broader. And, you know, we were talking around the 100 day's mark for Trump, especially about his freewheeling style with the media and how just how many things he's throwing out there on a daily basis. And I'm wondering if you can walk us through that a little bit. And I just wonder if this is pervading the Republican Party in Washington more generally.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons you talk to White House insiders about this that they will take from this, if this is successful, is that Donald Trump needs to do less talking. The more he's out there publicly talking and giving interviews about his legislative priorities, particularly when he's asked about the details, the worse it tends to go. I mean, he got wrong the details about the pre-existing conditions in an interview. And then there was one day where it was Monday, so it was the sort of first business day after his 100-day mark, where he gave this series of interviews in which it was like one was more bizarre than the next. He questioned whether the Civil War needed to happen.
Why? People don't ask that question. But why was there the Civil War? Why could that one not have been worked out?
He said he'd be honored to meet with Kim Jong-un, the North Korean dictator.
Would you speak to the leader of North Korea? I said, absolutely. Why not? Why not? Who the hell cares? I'll speak to anybody.
He floated and then backed away from attacks on gas, which is really a Republican anathema to sort of Republican orthodoxy. He said he was looking at breaking up the big banks. We had a great story by our colleague Josh Dawsey, the inimitable Josh Dawsey, who wrote a story where he quoted Douglas Brinkley, the presidential historian, saying that particular day on which all those interviews came out, while they were trying to corral support for this healthcare overhaul, he said, quote, "It seems to be among the most bizarre recent 24 hours in American presidential history." So that's a pretty high bar. And it just goes to show how distracting it can be when Trump is the one who is trying to message on. I mean, in some ways, his sort of chaotic messaging has worked really well for him. It worked well for him during the campaign. It works a lot less well when he's trying to push through a piece of legislation where messaging and staying on message is so important.
All right, let's jump from here into our second segment. I think what the stuff that Ken just said is a really good segue into this. Our second data point is 52, and that's how many months former Republican Senator Jim DeMint spent as the president of the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, until, as the Nerdcast trio of Nancy and Ken and Eliana Johnson, who's not here this week, scooped last week.
Feel DeMint, better, Eliana.
DeMint was ousted by his board of directors at Heritage, sending shockwaves through the infrastructure of the conservative movement. Nancy, explain to us, why is this a big deal? What's the role that the Heritage Foundation typically plays in Washington, especially in situations like right now when Republicans have control of the White House and Congress?
It was a huge deal, and it was quite surprising that it was sort of happening now because, as you said, Republicans control everything, and the Heritage Foundation has built such close ties to this administration just through a lot of its alumni working there inside the administration and also just inside the agencies and on the transition that it was surprising that it happened. But it's a big deal because, one, they've written a lot of policy proposals that they're trying to urge the administration to adopt, and then, two, they have this lobbying arm called Heritage Action, which basically threatens members and promises to primary them if they don't necessarily agree with Heritage's pretty conservative principles. Heritage, for instance, really wanted Trump to repeal Obamacare immediately as soon as he took office and has been super vocal about that throughout this whole healthcare debate and has been, I wouldn't say like the only player or, the most influential one, but certainly a vocal voice that has contributed to, this real drumbeat to make sure that the repeal happens. And they'll probably do the same on things like tax reform or if there's an infrastructure package. And so they play this big political role in making their sort of positions known. And then historically, they've played this policy role in sort of helping to shape conservative thought and giving administrations sort of these packaged policy ideas that they've already done all this research on. During the Reagan administration, for instance, they were hugely influential. I think the Reagan administration adopted something like 60% of their policy proposals in the first term.
And wow. What's so surprising about this is that at this moment, Heritage is perhaps even more, it's at least as relevant as it was during the Reagan administration, perhaps even more relevant. And it is at a time when many of the institutions that sort of form the backbone of the foundation of the conservative movement or the sort of ideas factory of the Republican Party are struggling for relevance. Heritage under Jim DeMint took a gamble. They got in with Trump at a time when many of these other institutions were sort of turning up their nose at him. And as a result, Trump became extremely reliant on him. And many of his transition team was largely staffed by Heritage Foundation folks, and some of his top sort of advisors and donors have ties to Heritage. And so the fact that when Heritage seems to be at the cusp of sort of dominance, that they're making a leadership change, says a number of things, I think, about the fractious nature of the Republican Party and the conservative movement under Trump in the Trump years. In fact, our reporting suggested that some of the board members and some of the folks, influential folks at Heritage, were a little bit leery, in some cases a lot bit leery, about the organization aligning itself with Trump so much. And they started turning on DeMint, you know, in some cases well before the presidential campaign, but certainly during the presidential campaign, that sort of catalyzed some of the opposition to him. And some of the folks who I talked to said that they were, if Trump would have lost, DeMint would have been gone much faster. There wouldn't have been this debate. It would have been a much cleaner break. But the fact that it became so difficult to cast him out at a time when he, you know, when he had brought the Heritage Foundation to this point of relevance, is, I think, emblematic of something going on in the broader conservative movement.
I think it's also reflective of tectonic changes in the Washington political ecosystem. And, you know, as Nancy mentioned before, like, this used to be the ideas factory. You mentioned that too. And their role was so much different. They didn't see themselves as principals. You know, now in Washington, where it's almost like everything is militarized, everything is weaponized, everything is politicized. You couldn't just be the policy nerds generating papers and hoping to maybe advance ideas or fuel the debate. You have to be part of it. And I think that's part of the thinking in bringing in somebody like DeMint. And the other part of the tectonic nature of these changes, I think, is bringing in somebody who symbolized New Washington, like DeMint. Remember, DeMint, the first, you know, for many people, their first introduction to him was in his sharp-elbowed method of operating within the Senate. You know, he didn't really care that much about the old ways of doing things in the Senate and decorum. He was very upfront about it and basically said, I'd rather have 30 conservatives than 60 moderates. And it reflects
a kind of Tea Party.
Yeah. And it reflects a kind of conservatism that's very different than Reagan's sunny conservatism. It's a more populist brand of combative conservatism. And DeMint is a perfect example of that. And bringing him in and also establishing a political arm for a think tank would have been unheard of at one point.
Well, and to be fair, that lobbying arm was established before DeMint came in, and it was established under Ed Fulner, who's the former president of Heritage, who's going to be the interim president, and who was there during this whole Reagan era. But that lobbying arm sort of complicated things so much for Heritage's relationships on the Hill, and just the way that it operated, that it almost sort of overtook a lot of the policy ideas. And when DeMint came in, he just accelerated that. And a lot of the policy experts that were, you know, well-known in conservative circles kind of either saw the writing on the wall or were pushed out when DeMint came in.
There's a line from Nancy, from the story that you and Eliana wrote, the most recent story that you wrote about this, that really jumped out to me, is that both organizations, referring to Heritage and Heritage Action, became increasingly focused on mediating fights among congressional Republicans rather than on generating policy ideas. It seems to me that you could that speaks more broadly than just to the Heritage Foundation. We were talking about healthcare before. We're going to be talking about tax reform in the months to come. This is a problem more broadly among the Republican Party right now. That's definitely, I think, it seems to me, like, been focused a lot more on figuring out some of its own internal stuff than what it wants to do in some cases.
Yeah, and DeMint wasn't necessarily like a great guy. I think if they knew that was the position that they were going to be in, they wouldn't have picked him. Now, of course, there's a little bit of a chicken or egg thing here. DeMint, in some ways, created some of these divisions. He was one of the guys who was sort of pouring lighter fluid on the flames, you know, during the Tea Party. I mean, you call him proto Tea Party. No, I mean, he was like one of the godfathers of the Tea Party. He was one of the few people, high level federal elected officials who the Tea Party really gravitated to. And he really fanned the flames of the Tea Party in, you know, 2009, 2010. And that created some of the rifts that you could trace ultimately to Trump, the populism and the sort of anti-establishment feeling. But he, as Charlie alluded to, had developed this reputation for sharp elbows. And so he created these divisions, and then he went to Heritage Action in particular, ended up going, you know, becoming sort of an anti-incumbent, anti-establishment group, which it never was. I mean, it was always sort of like stodgy and, you know, the tweed jacket with the leather arm patch type of, you know, conservative. And so it was a change, and it was a trade-off. They became relevant in a real way, both during the Tea Party years and then under Trump. But they also developed this reputation that ultimately was problematic and arguably did dement in.
Well, I also feel like, you know, following the 2012 election when Mitt Romney lost, there was this whole soul searching among Republican policy wonks that, you know, they had to come up with new policy ideas that spoke to Americans in the middle class, like, you know, ways that Republicans could talk about helping people afford college costs or, you know, tax credits for families. And that was sort of forgotten in this election. Well, maybe, you know, Marco Rubio talked about it a little bit and Jeb Bush did. But there was this whole sense here that, you know, the Republicans couldn't just be about tax cuts or this country club party. And then Trump came along and, you know, basically blew everything out of the water and sort of had his own ideas about policy ideas about how to appeal to Americans. And I feel like Heritage, you know, didn't necessarily, you know, come up with these new policy ideas for him. They just joined forces and like helped him give rise to the politics. And that was definitely part of the complaints of the board member. Like they want fresh new ideas.
And I think Dement is fascinating because he also represents a new breed of conservative in Washington, and conservative lawmaker, that is. Meaning there's a big difference between the folks who came in after the 1994 Reagan Revolution and those who were there beforehand. Meaning there was a generation of Republicans who were accustomed to a very different Washington and that were accustomed to eating humble pie every night. The Democrats rubbed it in their face when they had the House majorities. Remember, the Democrats held the House for, you know, nearly a half century uninterrupted. And that there was a brand of Republicans that live under that. Then there came a generation of Republicans that never lived in that, that came to Washington and only knew a Republican House or were only familiar with a House where Republicans were on the ascent or in control of one chamber or another. And I think Dement is reflective of that thinking that they've never had to really work with Democrats. They didn't know a Washington where on occasion the parties could work together. And I think the way he operated as head of Heritage in many ways reflected that style.
I'm very curious to know, and curious, Ken or Nancy, if this has come up in any of your reporting, what's next for Dement? Like we talked about, this is a guy who was at the vanguard of the Tea Party movement. He turned his leadership PAC, Senate Conservatives Fund, into and later a super PAC, Senate Conservatives Action, into one of the premier financing vehicles for anti-incumbent primary challengers, for folks like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz when they were running for those open seats against more establishment-minded Republican primary opponents. I wonder what's next.
Dement, I talked to one of Dement's allies on Tuesday night, and basically Dement's not going out quietly. I mean, he listed, you know, the Heritage board voted Tuesday afternoon to officially oust him and not renew his contract. It was dramatic and public. But, you know, Dement, rather than skulk away, basically issued his own statement Tuesday evening. It was a page and a half long saying that the board was wrong. There hadn't been management problems there. He listed all of his accomplishments. And then he went to a party near Heritage with a bunch of his allies and Heritage employees and, you know, was tweeting the next day. And I think he's already thinking about, you know, in my conversations with people close to him, he's already thinking about what to do next. And I think there'll be an announcement in the next couple of weeks. But Dement is not leaving Washington. He seems like he is not going home to South Carolina.
He's got to be kind of kicking himself in some ways. I mean, you know, he could have held that seat probably as long as he wanted. No one was going to primary him from the right. Yeah, the Senate seat that he left. It was a shock when he did. When he left the Senate, he resigned in the middle of his term to go take over at Heritage. So he's got to be kicking himself. at least a little bit. Also interesting that, you know, this guy who's this anti-Washington crusader is going to stick around Washington and maybe form or, you know, hook up with another group. I think also interesting is what happens with Heritage. As Nancy mentioned, Fulner is viewed, or he's being billed as, an interim replacement. We had heard some talk when some of this was going down that maybe this was to create a landing pad for Steve Bannon, a White House advisor who a lot of knives are out for inside the White House. I don't know that that's necessarily the case, but it was interesting speculation, both because it dovetailed with this move to sort of push Bannon out of the White House, and because we did understand that Rebecca Mercer, a name that we bloat a lot, a top Trump advisor, top Trump donor, Heritage board member, was influential in pushing out the Mint. And so she is a close ally of Bannon. In fact, she got Bannon hired on onto the Trump campaign. So start looking at these connections and maybe wondering if the realignment of Heritage may not steer the organization away from Trump, may continue with that sort of positioning that has brought it so much relevance.
Nancy, last word.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rebecca Mercer is on the board there. I don't think that she was among sort of the small group really, really pushing out DeMint. But I do think one other thing that could happen, which we all reported, which I think is perhaps one of the most likely scenarios, is that this guy, Michael Needham, who runs Heritage Action and who is like a protege of Ed Fulner's and who's in his mid-30s, there's a potential, I think, for him to potentially step in. And so we'll see, you know, we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, having spent the last few minutes here talking about the role of these conservative institutions and in changing Washington, let's change tacks a little bit and talk about the thinning ideological middle in Congress. And the data point I have for that is 15. That's how many members of the current Congress have already called it quits. And that's all in the House, with some taking cabinet jobs or running for higher office and others just straight up announcing their retirement. And there was a particularly interesting one last weekend. Ileana Rosletinen, a Republican from Miami, announced her retirement, which leaves open the Republican seat where Donald Trump did worst in 2016, where he won less than 40% of the vote. Nevertheless, Rosletinen still won re-election, but that seat is going to be open in 2018. And this comes a month after Tim Walz, a Democrat from Minnesota, announced he would run for governor, which leaves open the second worst Democratic seat for Hillary Clinton, where she got under 40%. So, Charlie, we've barely gotten accustomed to some of the contours of the, you know, how the presidential results played out in some of these congressional districts. And already we're seeing signs of the, you know, the shrinking moderate edges in both parties potentially receding even further once the next congressional election rolls around.
Yeah, it didn't get a ton of attention, her retirement in Washington, but I think it's a very big loss for the Republican Party for a couple of reasons. The first is that she was a big personality, big charismatic personality, who thought and stylistically was very different than the rest of the Republican conference. She was Cuban American. She was, in favor of gay rights before it was cool. She was a moderating influence within the conference. And she also, you know, it just in pure political terms, she held a seat that is gone now. Like, there is a very little chance that Republicans can hold that seat, in part because she was a great fit for it. And she was like a class of member that doesn't exist so much anymore. There used to be a time when you, before the House landscape hardened, where you could have a member who was maybe ideologically, you know, off base for the district. It wasn't a great fit. Like when I was growing up, Ken, you might remember this, when we were kids, there was Bob Edgar. He was in the Pennsylvania suburbs, just like wild-eyed liberal member, out of the anti-war movement, who was representing—
Went on to lead Common Cause.
Went on to lead Common Cause. He led a largely Delaware County-based district that was very Republican, like hardcore Republican, down the line, pull the lever for Republicans. And it was crazy that a guy that liberal could represent a district that conservative. But people kept voting him in part because he worked really hard, but also because they liked him. And I think the divisions were not quite so hardened there. And you had lots of members like that across the country sitting in seats that they really had no business sitting in, but they were able to hold those seats by sheer dint of personality, work habits, and the fact that people were open to members of the other party if they could make their case. And you saw all of those members cleaned out of the South in the late 90s and in over the last decade. And, the last remaining holdouts were cleaned out in 2010. So now almost every member of Congress is completely in ideological lockstep with their constituency. And so that gets back to Rosletinen. She was not. Like, this is a pretty Democratic district. And for a Republican to hold it, you have to be, you know, really a unique character. And she was like that. And so even though there's actually, you know, probably a few prospects in a district like that, pretty decent Republican prospects, I don't see, you know, much hope for them holding that seat.
You know, there's a lot of talk about how polarization is, you know, largely the result of redistricting and gerrymandering efforts to craft districts so that they are solidly one party or the other. But in this case, I agree with you. It's more that there's sort of more of like a personality element going on here. I mean, this district had changed, but it didn't change because of redistricting. The demographics of it changed because of immigration. It got younger, it had more immigrants. Also, it was a big gay community, and she was very out front, particularly as a Republican, in support of gay rights. So this would have been, however, the, you know, the any efforts to like change the district would not have necessarily dislodged her. It took her deciding to leave. And while we don't know precisely why, we can sort of extrapolate and look at the polarization within the conferences, within the caucuses in Congress, in the House, that are much more rigid than they were perhaps when she first entered Congress, that made it much less hospitable for a member like her.
Can I use this opportunity to just talk about my hobby horse and go on a rant about gerrymandering? Because I agree with you, you know, about the role of gerrymandering. But this idea that gerrymandering, and I'm not saying you are forwarding this, but this idea that gerrymandering or redistricting is the root of all evils in our political system is crazy. It is so misleading. And I mean, gerrymandering has been going on for a long time. We read all these stories. People are always talking about how bad the Republican gerrymander was this time, as if it's some sort of Republican invention that they've rigged the system. I can remember back in the 90s when I first started reporting that the legislative leader in California, the House Speaker, used to joke about California's map, which completely screwed Republicans. He called it his contribution to modern art. You know, that people were laughing about it back then. And the problem with gerrymandering isn't the lines of the districts matter a great deal. But the problem is us here, the voters listening. You know, the problem is residential patterns. People want to live with people who think like them. There's a great book about this by Bill Bishop called The Big Sort, just talking about the way we've settled as a nation, and we want to live among people who think like that. And that is a big factor behind why our districts are drawn the way they do. And this is not to downplay the role played by gerrymandering, because it is pernicious, but it's not the biggest problem facing us.
I also think that there's, you know, this storyline that, you know, there's this ability to like scientifically engineer these districts because of all the sophisticated software and technology that we have that allows us to, you know, break down to the house level and, you know, draw these maps and come up with all these different possibilities that we can figure out just precisely what is required for like one party to have as many seats as possible in a given state. This is state legislatures are the ones who use the sophisticated software to do the redistricting every 10 years based upon the results of the U.S. Census. And I just don't think that that's the case. I think that's an oversimplified way to look at it. And I remember covering the post-2000 census legislative redistricting process in Pennsylvania when I was a reporter in Harrisburg for the Wilkes-Barre Times Leader shout out. But the Republicans controlled the state legislature, and Pennsylvania was losing two seats, so they were looking for a way to redraw the lines of the district so that they could essentially like push out a bunch of Democrats, and it totally backfired. I mean, they ended up putting George Geekus in this seat. They had to pit essentially like, you know, they were like pitting members against each other. So they put like pit George Geekus against Tim Holden in the seat that was like drawn for Republicans, and Holden like creamed him because Geekus was like a horrible candidate.
A blue dog Democrat.
And he was like 180 years old too.
Yeah, exactly. Like they aired ads of him like falling asleep. But nonetheless, it just shows that like no matter how you draw the line, some of this personality stuff and actual connection with voters does matter.
Well, and also, I think the thing I would say about this is that I think there's, like Charlie said, there's a tendency for people to blame redistricting 100% or sorting 100%, when in fact these things are inextricably married to each other and play off each other. But the thing about redistricting and gerrymandering is that it's always, by nature, it's backward looking. You can't plan for what's going to happen in the future. Florida Republicans, when they were drawing their congressional maps, could not have anticipated that Donald Trump was going to end up becoming president of the United States, having run a campaign that alienated a lot of Hispanic voters like we have in Florida's 27th district. And all of a sudden, you know, you get these changes there or in rural Minnesota, like we talked about, where they, you know, suddenly the parties aren't quite aligned the way they were when just 6 years ago these maps were drawn.
Here's a test for our listeners. Think about where you live. Think about the precinct that you live in, the county, or even the congressional district. Is it competitive? I would say in most cases, it's not. Meaning, is it about a 50-50 breakdown? Maybe 58-42, something like that? 55-45? Probably not. Like if I think of my precinct is about 98% single party. And it, you know, looking around, knowing where you guys live, I suspect the same thing. And that's not just the DC metro area. That is in many, many places.
And I got to correct myself also. Holden narrowly defeated Geekus. Nonetheless, that district was very heavily draw for. Many people just expected Tim Holden to retire. Not only did he not retire, he ended up edging out.
Did we not just have a discussion about not getting too granular? What is wrong with you?
Well, I got to correct. We can't let that stand.
Well, there's actually a funny thing about this. So Tim Holden, right, this Democrat who Republicans desperately were trying forever to draw out of his seat, had a conservative enough voting record that he was able to hold on. And finally, in 2011, when the next round of redistricting came around, Republicans gave up. They decided, we can't possibly beat Tim Holden. We're going to draw a Democratic vote sink. We're going to get all the possible Democratic votes we can in central and northeastern Pennsylvania, draw them into one district and just stick him there so we don't have to worry about trying to beat him anymore. And you know what happened? Tim Holden lost the Democratic primary in 2012 to Matt Cartwright, who's now still in Congress. And then fast forward to 2016, Donald Trump ran incredibly strong. I think he won that district. And now people are talking about Cartwright potentially being in jeopardy in the next congressional elections because of the possibility of Trump voters kind of crossing over against Democrats.
You know that Tim Holden was one of the first races I ever covered as a reporter.
I did not know that.
When he was running for an open seat. And this is why I learned one of the most important lessons about politics from it. So I go out to his district, which was awesome because I got to go to a Yangling factory, which was there.
Pottsville, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. That's the original.
Yeah, it was the original.
That's where he's
from.
Yeah,
built into the side of the mountain. It was awesome. So I spent a couple days with him, and including a long night and a long car ride with him in just torrential downpour. But what I discovered from that was that what most people cared about and when they talked to him was not anything but his grandfather. So his grandfather was a professional baseball player, I think. I think his name was Sox Holden. And that's all people wanted to talk to. Here I was, like this young reporter, expecting this deep conversation about the issues and what people really cared about. And they all want to know about Sox Holden.
That's amazing. We promised not to get too granular.
I was like shopping for a handbag on my computer, yeah, like in the middle of some of this.
A Tim Holden segment.
Full disclosure to our listeners.
But I think just to bring this back around, we're talking about Ileana Ross Lehtinen in Florida. We mentioned Tim Walz in Minnesota's first district running for governor. This is a district that went heavily for Trump. Walz actually just barely won re-election. Talking about Tim Holden replaced by Matt Cartwright in these days. When people like Ross Lehtinen and Walz retire, there's often a fight for their districts the first time around. But then once those districts flip, they stay. If Democrats do manage to win Florida's 27th district in Miami from Ross Lehtinen, that could well be a solid Democratic district for the foreseeable future with someone who's going to vote down the line. And when the reason I wanted to bring these up today is when you add up, over the course of a number of years, people like Ross Lehtinen or Tim Walz or whoever else going for the exit, you can start to see how this happens. One by one by one, those districts kind of fall off the moderate edge of one party and get lumped in right smack in the middle of the other caucus.
That's a really great point, because if you just isolate those two districts, the Ross Lehtinen district in Miami, which has Miami Beach and a very urban district, and then the Tim Walz district in rural Minnesota, most likely, just looking at it from far away right now, there's a very good chance that each of them flips. So that Minnesota district goes Republican and Ross Lehtinen's goes Democratic. That just hardens the two parties, because right now there are very few places where Democrats hold seats in rural America. And we saw a reflection of that in the Trump vote. So now the Democratic caucus is going to become more urbanized. It's going to become more coastal and more affluent by adding that district. And the Republican conference is going to become more rural and more conservative because it adds another district there. And you begin to see how the lines get hardened and why we can't accomplish anything in our national legislature because of things like that, the hardening of the House landscape.
There's also Democrats look at this as a great sign, and they're like pretty excited about 2018. The combination of these special elections that we've seen them outperform what was expected with some of these retirements, with the historical trends where the opposition party does do very well in the first midterms of a sitting president, all sort of augur well for Democrats.
That's a really great point. Not only are, I think one last point I think we can, as we're running out of time here, but not only are Democrats starting to feel good about 2018, they do still have a pretty steep hill to climb. They would need 24 seats to net 24 seats, not just win. So if they lose a seat like Walz's, they'd have to gain 25 and so on and so forth. But even if they don't get to 24 and take over the House, there's an interesting scenario where if they gain, say, 10 seats or something like that, you know, we talked at the beginning of the show about the narrow margins for action in Congress, and a Republican House majority that lost another 8 or 10 of those battleground district, more moderate members, it's interesting to imagine what that would mean for the party trying to cobble together majority votes for anything going forward.
Can anything get done, Nancy? I mean, in an environment where the parties become more hardened and the legislative majority gets even smaller for Republicans?
Well, I think that just makes it a lot harder because it means that you have to basically have all the Republicans on board because the Democrats are so far on the other side that they're never, ever going to join you. So it's going to be like, you know, how the Democrats had to pass Obamacare totally on a party line vote. That's going to be like that with every single thing Trump brings up, probably, including tax reform, this healthcare bill, potentially infrastructure they could compromise. But, you know, it just means that there's not a lot of bipartisanship.
This is the most depressing Nerdcast ever.
but we've had a lot of laughter. Guys, thank you so much for being here today. Thank you, Nancy.
Oh, I love being here. Thanks.
Ken?
Fun time as always.
And Charlie.
Thanks, Scott.
And of course, as always, a big thank you to our listeners. If you enjoy the Nerdcast, please rate, subscribe, and write a written review of us on iTunes or your preferred podcast platform. The more feedback we get, the higher we rise on the charts, and the more people can discover the Nerdcast and share it with you. And also, here's that survey URL again, politico.com/podcast survey. It takes just 2 minutes, and it's going to help Politico create even better podcasts. So please, if you just have a couple minutes, take the time. And remember, if you have any questions, you can always email us at nerdcast@politico.com. Couple more thank yous. Once again, thank you so much to our listeners. Thank you to our panel. And thank you to executive producer Bridget Mulcahy, Nerdcast illustrator Bill Cookman, and our researcher and Politico web producer Zach Montalaro. And also thank you to Michael Schwab here in the studio this week. We will talk to you again next week.